This ROFM podcast was brought to you with the support of New Zealand On Air.
It's welcome, welcome, welcome to the September Book Lovers Wire Wrapper program. I'm Gareth Rapson and I'm here with Steve Lawrence.
Hello, Gareth.
And we're going to talk about books. Books and all their expansive everything. Now, Steve, let's begin with our.
Aren't you supposed to say where people can find us?
Oh, people can find us. We're in 92.7 Arrow FM. That's very, very good. And I hope you've been listening to Janet Frame and going to, you know, listening to it live on air. Have you been doing that?
Work?
Yeah. Be busy, of course. And you can find us on Channel 41 and Wairarapa Freeview TV. As always, Steve, what's happening with the Y Word? Because we had Ra Smith.
Ra came along on the first Sunday of September, which was in fact the 1st of September, and talked to a pretty good crowd, actually, about Wairarapa stories, stories of wetlands, stories of how he got into stories. He was quite a
good raconteur.
He's great, Ra. He told this little story at the beginning about how he was out with his grandfather and some of his cousins. This is a while ago, obviously, and they were talking about things that, you know, can be under bridges and why you shouldn't go there. And one of the kids said, "Well, that's because there's a troll under there." And his grandmother found out about that and said, "Well, we don't have trolls here. That they have them in Norway. We have this whole other panoply of whether mythical or just elusive characters from Maori folktale stories." So there was a.
And
it's quite charming.
Excellent. And Akiwi Brown was mentioned last month, Christina Sanders. How's all that shaping up?
Yeah, pretty well. So, as I think I said last month, but I'll tell everybody again because no one can remember anything, least of all me. Every 2 years, David Headley runs his Yarns and Barns Festival. And last time, and in fact this time, we at Y Word have, just to take a bit of pressure off him because he doesn't have a big team, looked after an event for him. So, again, in our tradition of being on the first Sunday of every month, except for the 11 months of the year when we're not, we'll be, in fact, on a Tuesday night on the 22nd of October. And we will have, as I think I said last time, but I'll say it again, Christina Sanders coming along to at 7:30 in the evening to the courthouse in Carterton to talk about her works of historical New Zealand fiction.
Is there a new book in the one?
There is. Well, Akiwi Brown is a couple of months old now.
Oh, okay.
But that's
still current.
That's the weaving of the Burke and Hare mysteries with Akiwi Brown, who was a real person who ran an establishment of somewhat ill repute in Eastbourne. So it's kind of a murder mystery.
Yeah, no, because Christina's good. Our book club really liked The Wreck of the General Grant. And, you know, she's no doubt she's got a finger on the New Zealand historical fiction pulse.
Yeah. And as I always tell everybody, everything I learned, all the history I ever learned, I learned from historical novels, relying on the fact that the person who wrote them was telling the truth. So just talking about book clubs, so we have our own little book club at Elmo's, which is also generally on the first Sunday of the month that Rosalie, my offsider, runs. And the book that they are doing next, or discussing next month, will in fact be Akiwi Brown, because they did read The Wreck of the General Grant, Mrs. Jewell and The Wreck of the General Grant. And they all like that, so they're reading this one. I've got some notes here from Rosalie, who says, great book club book. after the first few pages, I knew I was going to like this book. Because so, she's got a nice straightforward style. They're good to read, and you find out stuff. And you know, the part of this is the O'Kiwi Brown's Hotel at Rona Bay was on the way to Wairarapa, and where people were driving their stock around from Wellington, they stopped there overnight, which is, you know, nowadays you just chuck them on the truck and half an hour later you can unload them, but didn't was not always like that. So, and just also talking about our book club, Rosalie's book club, on the first Sunday of September, which also happened to be the first, we did have Charity Norman actually come along to talk about her new book, Home Truths. She kind of volunteered to do that. That was well attended and much appreciated. Home Truths is a... Her charity's previous book, Remember Me, was... Well, that could have been set in Carterton, but it was actually based in Southern Hawke's Bay somewhere, but somewhere where you could walk into the hills from, and the landscapes were sort of understandable and notable. This is set in Yorkshire, so, and she is in fact English.
An expat, no doubt. Yes, okay.
And she's a barrister, and there's a sort of quite a lot of this book is actually takes place in a courtroom, so you can see that she knows what she's talking about. And it's interesting because she was a barrister, but I read the little dedication at the back where she talks about sending off sort of Facebooky notes to her sister, who's a King's Counsel and a judge, so where they could compare notes on.
So all those legal readers out there,
yeah,
which I happen to live with one, would actually sound like they'd quite enjoy that book.
Well, it's a cut across thing because it's really about misinformation and people who have access to grind about vaccinations.
That's got me my interest. Yeah,
she's a very good writer.
Right. Excellent. Now, Steve, when I was in the bookshop, I picked up your Carterton Space Week. What's all that about?
Well, you probably know because you live here that Wairarapa is, or bits of it from the Wainawa South, are a dark sky reserve.
Right.
And we, Go Carterton, the business group in association with the council who funded a little bit, have put together what will be our second Space Week, which is timed to fit in with the World Space Week.
Right.
We owe that to Sam and Harry from Milky Way Kiwi. Harry is the New Zealand coordinator for Space Week. She used to work for NASA, so she's been around. I wouldn't say that, but she's has got some credit in this area. So there's a program of events over that.
I'm just looking at the program at the back. It looks really good. And who did the graphics? I mean, here's the Carterton clock tower sitting there prominently. I mean,
I don't know.
Terrific. You know, look good little pattern.
I should say that there is an event actually in the bookshop on the Sunday the 6th, which is a space-related family quiz. So,
I think I saw it.
Yeah,
there's a Degrassi book there, the astrophysics.
That's a bit of an accident, but we've accumulated. Yeah, actually, yeah. We've got quite a lot of stuff on spacey stuff.
And before we move on to looking at some books, how did just from a retailing point of view from Ad Elmos, how did the Daffodil Weekend go? Because you were a little bit, when we talked before the weekend, you were looking for that weather window, which you got.
Which we got.
I don't know how you'd organise that, but well done you.
Yeah, I don't know who was praying to who or what, but we had a pretty soggy, pretty scruffy Saturday, a very soggy Saturday night, and a very, when I was driving in about 8 o'clock on Sunday morning through thick, misty, Scottish rubbish, thinking, yes. Oh my God. And then the time we got to the top of Chester Road, it all cleared up. And although it was never really tropical, it was pretty good all day.
It looked pretty buzzy on the streets. And Elmo's people bought books?
Yeah, we had a good day.
Excellent. That's what we wanted to
Cafe
hear.
Cafe was busy.
busy with all those new books that you're going to actually end up talking about shortly. Right. Let me start off with a book here, Roman Karzenik. What a good name. History for Tomorrow. Now,
He must be Polish because he doesn't have any vowels in his name, does he?
No. No, I've looked at it. It's got to be Krzyżanek. That'll do me. Mr. Krzyżanek, Roman as we'll call him. Inspiration from the past for the future of humanity. And I really enjoyed this. I'm only a third into it, and I'm going, this could be one of my top 10 for the year. So, and it's full of ideas. It's kind of very, very insightful and hopeful. I think he's a professor in, Oxford or Cambridge or one of those people who look at the past and go, like, how do our current problems, how have they actually occurred previously, like inequality of wealth or immigration issues or, social media, which we tend to think is a very new thing. Well, but in fact, it's been a form of it is always there.
Town criers and things, you mean?
Yeah, it is.
Bring out your dead, that sort of thing.
And it's kind of like, do you need radical revolts to really make things change? And often you do. And he starts off talking about slavery and in sort of the Caribbean, there was a huge revolt there in the 17th century, and 20,000 slaves just took over.
And that was Haiti, wasn't it?
And Haiti, yeah, all that area, and it caused the ripple effect of that. In fact, got England into the abolition of slavery. But, the consequences were quite, horrific. I mean, 650 were charged, of the slaves, and 350 were executed. And they agreed, actually, to change, to abolish kind of slavery. So the owners got 40% compensation. It was like 37,000 Englishmen had investments there.
Hmm.
And it was like Kaepernick says it was worth about $350 billion in today's money, and it's been paid over all those centuries. It's still being paid off into those families. But it took radical change to get change. And he goes, is that the way we need to really move the dial? I mean, in it, or, are we, and it's a very hopeful book about, in fact, how... how things could. I mean, he predicts. He goes, America, United States could be like six different countries. He reckons, and by
it's 50, isn't it?
Yeah, but he thinks that it will, really like Russia and actually devolve, And so that's an interesting line of thinking to go.
I think if they tried that once, it didn't work out well.
No. That's right. They did. They did try that once. And anyway. Full of neat books, and it had a great section on social media. And I'll ask the question here: how many coffee houses do you think were in London in 1700?
Well, I know there was Lloyd's, and there must have been at least one other.
Yeah, and it was something like 2,000,
and
it was absolutely the kind of melting pot idea that. The coffee houses, you'd go in and for your penny you'd get your little thing of coffee, and you could sit around the outside in booths and all that. But in the middle there'd be this huge table full of all the pamphlets and writings of the day, of which you could sit around and talk with friends or with strangers and debate all the bits and pieces were there. And people would be adding notes to things that were written there, and people would be visiting it who had left stuff there several times a day
just to see if anybody had updated
their post.
Which is
a very modern idea of how we, go on our tablets, go back to
see
how
many likes have I got,
and all that sort of stuff. But also, it was that was the social media of the time, and it's a wonderful book. I actually, I'll probably drive people. It's like, how do you make change happen? It's kind of a big question.
Change happens all the time, and you only notice it if it's happening gradually, when you look back either a week or a year or 10 years and say, well, it's different now, but nothing specifically happened that made it different, but it is different. And yeah. I think most change is like that. But you're right, every now and then there's a,
A big correction.
It's a schism.
Well, a revolution or something that absolutely smashes things out.
Mm.
Okay, now over to you. What have you got?
Well, while we're doing non-fiction-y stuff, we've just got this, which is Yuval Noah Harari's new book, Nexus. People are probably familiar with Sapiens and Homo Deus. But this, I think in the end, this might be his most important book because, leading on from what we were just talking about, A Brief History of Information Networks from the Stone Age to AI. So what he's talking about is specifically and more recently about, well, I'll quote from the back, the internet promised infinite knowledge. The algorithm learned our secrets and then turned us against each other, which is kind of where we are now. What will AI do? And that's...
Now, he's readable. I mean, he is totally, you know, draws you in and has a huge world following after Sapiens. And, you know, and this is a book that, you know, let's face it, AI is just so much in our lives and in the wind and in discussion, and we're seeing manifestations of it everywhere, you know, on the media. So this book is going to help us think about this better?
I think it will, because he does help us think, partly because he's a very good writer. I mean, his prose is very good. It's not dumbed down, but it's straightforward. So he's good to read, and he is thoughtful.
It's fairly sizable. Well, we talk about this endlessly about what are these publishing houses doing? Is it, and how much paper in the world is
it? It's only 400 pages, but what he does, because he's a bit academic, there's about, I don't know, 70 or 80 pages of footnotes.
When you're reading, do you always like looking at it and going, oh, well, there's quite a lot of, you know, that stuff I don't have to read. This won't take as long as I, you know, I always do that. I go, oh, look at that, you know.
Well,
and some books, of course, have there's a paucity of footnotes, well, but these academics, they tick every box. So.
Well, that's right.
There's a tremendous amount of discussion and reviewing about this book. It's contentious, therefore it's adding to the discussion, and people, you know, are challenging some of the premises, and I guess we're asking our readers to say, hey, look, make up your own mind. This is a good sort of chewy book.
Yeah, well, I mean, I try and think about AI occasionally, and everybody says, well, it's going to change everything, and it probably will. And it's going to make lots of stuff better. But so far, all I find are slightly annoying things. Like I think I told you when I was sending a couple of emails this morning about Y Word, and the Gmail was trying to change Y Word into Wayward. Which it hasn't done before. So
no, it understands you intimately. AI is so ahead of it. It understands you, Steve, and it goes, Wayward, yeah, that's there it is.
Yeah. So you've got to keep your eye on it, that's what I'm saying. Otherwise you're going to be sending some very odd emails. But I think it does other stuff too. And I mean, this whole process of, you know, harvesting data, and he makes a point in here about, if information is the only thing that's got any value now, once upon a time the only thing that had any value was land, so it was not possible to control all of the land. It talks about the Roman empires where they set up a whole bunch of governors in various bits of the empire, and then they would do bad stuff and you have to go and kill them all and start again. And it was a real challenge to control all of the land. But it's no challenge to control all the data. You can suck it up, and you can just, and this is where the argument is, you can steal it from people. No one's, and it's only that if you get all of the data, then this thing, whatever it is, It knows everything, sees everything, and can do everything. And if it can, you know, I mean, I'm a bit paranoid about these things. If it knows everything, see everything, can do everything, and it can think for itself and teach itself, what are we here for?
We're here to switch it on.
Can you?
And maybe never switch it off. No, hey, that sounds a good, challenging book. And
it's a subject
certainly on my reading list. And yeah. Hey, there's a little blast from the past I'd like to pick up, and it's My Brilliant Friend by Eleanor Ferrante.
Yes.
And our wonderful neighbour comes over and tells us the story that she was in Sydney looking for something to read and was in a secondhand bookshop and picked up this and loved it intensely, and then found herself in Coolangatta and at another secondhand bookshop and went in and said, "Do you have the next one?" And they said, "Actually, we have the next three. We have, you know, to finish the quartet." And so, and she was saying, as she was finishing the last one, she was reading slower and slower because she did not want it to finish. Oh. And I thought, what a terrific reading thing. Anyway, she's brought it over, and Gail has read it.
Yes.
And I'm going to read it.
Yes.
And after, you know, hearing so much about it. And, you know, once, of course, it's in, you're noticing it. I suddenly saw an article saying this has been voted the greatest novel of the 21st century. Now, this is a contentious thing to say.
It's a bit early to say that because
Well, maybe it was the 20th century.
No,
it was published in 2012.
Yeah, it's definitely 21st century.
Yeah. So but far.
There's still quite a lot of century to go, that's my point.
It's a quarter done.
And it's a, yeah, things have to have, the test of time needs to be applied to some extent.
Yeah. Anyway, My Brilliant Friend is a rich and generous-hearted story about Eleanor and Leela, who grew up together in the 1950s in the poor neighbourhood on the outskirts of Naples. They learn to rely on each other and discover their destinies are bound up in the intensity of their relationship. Eleanor Ferrante's piercingly honest portrait of two girls' path into womanhood is also the story of a nation and a meditation on the nature of friendship itself. Regarded as a modern masterpiece.
Certainly, they were up till 3 or 4 years ago when the last one came out. They were a big thing.
Yeah. An expert above all in the rhythm of plotting, whether it's work, family, friends or sex, and Ferrante, perhaps thanks to her anonymity as an author, is blisteringly good on bad sex. Our greatest mistakes in life aren't isolated acts. We rehearse them over and over until we get them badly wrong as we can.
Yeah, because that was my understanding, that no one really knows who or what, if anything, Eleanor Ferrante is. But you think she gives lectures, so she must be someone.
I think she's the person in Italy. No one has a voice quite like Ferrante's. Her gritty, ruthless, frank novels roar off the page with a barbed fury, like an attack that's also in a defence. Ferrante's fictions are fierce, unsentimental glimpses of as the way a woman is constantly under threat, her identity submerged in marriage, eclipsed by motherhood, mythologized by desire. Imagine if Jane Austen got angry, and you've got some idea of how explosive these works are. I love the way the reviews are actually terrific. Mm. This book is as good as the reviewing. High-stakes, subversive literature. So I think this is going to be a mix of a kind of like the political and domestic. You know, it's going to be a small, but it's going to, and I'm only just holding it in my hand going, actually, this could be quite good. So, more than quite good. So I am, I will keep you informed on how that develops as we go, as we reach back a little bit. But instead of going back, let's go into the absolute newest.
Okay, so if I can, I'd like to talk about two books. And then you can have a turn. These are new, I suppose you'd call them crime. So we have a new Kate Atkinson, a Jackson Brodie novel, Death at the Sign of the Rook. So this is, I don't know which number of Jackson Brodie novel is, but she's written quite a few now.
Is it about the fourth or fifth?
Let's see if it says.
It usually has it.
Jackson Brodie, Case Histories, One Good Tune, 1, 2, 3, 4. Yes, this is the sixth one.
The sixth, okay.
Yeah. And she'd written a whole series of things, but...
It's in my list of, you know, should reads, and yeah. I have read Kate's standalones and yeah. have enjoyed them immensely.
Life After Life, and the one that came, that was the one that sort of kept on going around and around and around, and A God in Ruins, they were...
God in Ruins is classic.
So, they were...
yeah, it's...
One followed t'other.
That's racing off the shelves, I imagine.
Yeah, and these are... they're crime, but not really thrillers. They're not nothing. I mean, people get killed, obviously, because it's de rigueur.
That's the genre. But they.
Yes. But it's not. They're not unpleasant, and it is, you know, a homage to Agatha Christie. So this is sort of a country house.
Okay,
which thing is, where eventually, you know, people start dying.
No one's leaving, and the detective is in there sorting out and interviewing. Yeah, no, it's classic. It's a classic plot line, and it'll be always, remembered by, revisited is the word I'm looking for.
Yeah, and just today we got a new Richard Osman. Now, Richard Osman has written the Thursday Murder Club series, which he'd obviously had enough of. So his new book is called We Solve Murders, different set of characters, still older characters. But the thing, and you know, I talked about this a little bit before, these two books are, I suppose, a bit similar in that they're, I don't know, cosy crime or something. But this one has got a typeface about three times the size of anything you would normally see.
It's for seniors.
And it may well be for old readers. I don't know.
I'm not at the reading that thing, but I do appreciate sometimes a slightly bigger text. You seem to read them faster. There's more air and space.
Well, there is. I mean, he probably wanted to write a 400-page book, but he didn't want to put many words in it.
Yeah, it's a good question because we can't have it too small.
No.
And I'm a student of type. I often look at, if I admire the type, I want to go back to the, you know, into the back, find out what sort of type it is, because there's some absolutely stunning type, you know, types out there. But that is big.
It is. It is. People do prefer the trade paperback or the C format, which is this larger size, which is how things... books come out, and then in about a year they're generally made available as a B.
Yeah.
Which has it's a book which is about two-thirds of the size, same number of pages, and a much smaller typeface.
Mm.
So those of us who can't see as well as we used to, they tend to prefer the bigger ones. Oh, they're all about the same.
With the C format, you're not paying more. For the bigger book.
Yeah, you do. And well, in the sense that New Zealand and Australia are not hardback markets. I mean, this will be available in hardback, but it's not...
You've got to seek it out, though.
Yeah, it's a special order because they know no one wants to pay $49.99.
Unless you're a collector.
Unless you're a collector.
Right.
So generally, the trade paperbacks come out at about $37.99 or something, and then when they go to B format, they're about $27.99.
Okay, yep.
So you get that progression, and also, of course, it's a year or 18 months later. So, two interesting new works of fiction, and
crimey
one of the most interesting things is one of them's got typeface three times the size of the other.
Well, you know, if you do like a big type, there's a book we can point you towards.
Yes.
Cookbooks. Now, we every now and then we talk about cookbooks, and we've got over here Good Vibes, which vegetarian grandchild pointed me at, and it's a lovely book published by, let's see.
It'll be written on the book.
HarperCollins.
Mm-hmm.
Beautifully production values and cover and all that, and it's by... Albie Hales. Now, Albie is a young man, looking at his photo here, and he lives in Dunedin. And so it's a Kiwi book, which is always good because the products are the products that we find in our
Zild.
in our supermarkets, which can be rather annoying, our supermarkets, as we discover on TV, for the fact that they're gouging away at us.
Not for veggies lately.
I know, but yeah, that has come down. And this is the veggie book.
Yeah.
Albie Hales is a doctor, and he works in the mental health sector. And his deal is that actually food is good for, you know, good food is good for our mental health. Totally agree with that.
Has to be, doesn't it? It has to be, doesn't it?
It has to, yeah.
You are what you eat in the end, and the brain is just a series of chemical reactions.
So as I'm eating the chocolate, I can understand myself. He used to write food blogs, and then this is his very first book. And this, I think, comes out of his or the blogs under various guises. You suddenly then collect them all in, and it's about 120 recipes, about 80% kind of vegetarian, I guess. But that's the way it all rolls in New Zealand. And he won a TV. He put himself out there, and he won a New Zealand reality television program, which may have been the Bake Off, or is it the Great New Zealand Bake Off? Is there such a thing?
Yeah, there is.
Yeah, he won it.
Okay.
And it just shows you these contestants who go in it aren't like you and I going in onto the reality thing. They're absolutely dedicated foodies who have been studying this all their life and cooking and doing blogs and are an amazing cooks.
Well, you'd have to be, otherwise you'd make an absolute fool of yourself.
I know. It's my toasted sandwich is just not going to cut it in this sort of competition. Anyway, very good book for a Kiwi book. And, hey, I'm always going to look out for Kiwi cookbooks.
I can't.
But I'd love, I'm actually.
I recognise the cover, but I don't know if we have that or not. There's a lot.
I know, you have a lot, and it's kind of like, it's getting the best, because it's narrowing it down. But my vote I'm a cookbook provider for Gail.
Yes.
Who reads cookbooks for hot as a hobby and an enthusiasm. That's
right.
Her thing.
Yeah.
But she does like Kiwi stuff. Just for, because that's what surrounds us. But I see on your stack over there, we've got a William Boyd, which is very, very exciting for William Boyd fans like myself.
Yeah, we do. So this has just arrived. And I was saying, William Boyd, is he Irish?
He was born in Africa.
Oh, okay.
But he's actually English as English.
Yeah. Just that most of the writers are Irish, he says. I suppose, just the way his name's spelled, but he's a bit like John Boyne in that every book's about something different. There's no particular genre or style or character or anything. He just writes a whole range of different stuff. So this is a spy thriller. Wonderful, intricate novel of espionage and elegance, skullduggery. This is John Banville. Enjoyed it hugely. Boyd's one of my favourite authors, says Kate Atkinson. And you'll be impressed with this. William Boyd once again brings to the spy novel his particular storytelling genius. The result is brilliant fun. Mick Herron, who's the slow horses man.
Hey, look, that's three heavy hitters giving him the big tick. And look, he wrote Any Human Heart.
He did.
And after you've written that, you're going to have a following. So I can't wait, actually. That would be, that'll be sort of... Also, it's too early for Christmas, but I will be will be on my list.
Simply the best realistic storyteller of his generation, Sebastian Faulks.
So it just shows you, this is what happens. All these guys hang out together at literary festivals
and
become great mates, and then they just endorse each other's books.
Exactly. I think there's
I mean, if you wrote a book, I'd write a stunning endorsement of it. I mean, if you're going to look after your mates, that's how it works.
You could write the endorsement, but would you read it?
No, well, I wouldn't read it, but it would sound good. It would sound like I read it.
Yeah. So, I think this will be really cool. Again, I haven't read it. It's just got here, but...
Some of his books have been slightly longer, but that, as we are commenters on size, this looks like a winner.
250 pages, which, you know, that used to be how big books were.
That's right.
Before they got to be 5, 6, 7.
Before we started reading more.
We got an email from HarperCollins, said that the Boris, you know, I mean, the English Prime Minister.
Boris
Johnson.
That his
biography, which had, or book, biography, autobiography, had been sold, and when they've actually got delivery of it, turns out to be 300 pages longer than they expected, so it's now going to cost more.
So, well, a lot happened to the man.
I think he's pushed this up to about 900 pages.
There was a recent TV program that people, might have been a two-parter, that people said was stunning television, and in a way, that's how I'd like to probably consume Boris's story rather than read his, you know, rather fevered writing. Mind you, you'll probably find, because he's classically educated in, you know, England's finest universities, that he probably writes like a dream.
He probably does.
Yeah.
Probably makes a lot of stuff up too.
Let's go over the ditch. Australia. The Miles Franklin Award-winning author, Stephen Carroll.
Never heard of him.
Never heard of him. I know. And look at the cover.
Good cover.
Great little lively cover. And at the back, we're in Cambridge with its spires.
Yes.
Death of a Foreign Gentleman. A writer worth cherishing. Carroll's phrase is unfailingly assured, lyrical, and poised, the Australian. The reviewing in here of all his books is typically Australian. You know, it's like overblown and really over too excited and a little bit feverish, and
I think that's a bit unkind.
Aussies
as being a bit more sort of laconic.
I know.
They're pretty enthusiastic about themselves, but they're like us though.
They struggle to get at, you know, their writers out into the big world global markets. I see Tim Winton's got a new, is it a sci-fi book?
Something coming. Yeah,
something's coming in the wind.
Yeah.
Anyway, I picked up Death of a Foreign Gentleman, and he's written a lot of other things, but this is the first of a new crime series starring Detective Sergeant Stephen Minter, who is, and the book's set in Cambridge, 1947. A visiting German philosopher is here on a lecture series and is killed in the opening page. There's a suggestion of... it is a car cycle crash, but who did it? And there's no shortage of suspects, of course. Is it random bad luck? Has the universe spoken? Or is it more sinister forces at work? Playful, nice to read, slightly philosophical, which ticks the box for me. It's, you know, actually a little better... You know, this is a really good book for discussing how some parts really flowed and then some dead patches were hit. But some bits were really good. And everybody talks about how well he writes, and he does. He absolutely writes this just sort of prose that's just fun to... So he gets, even though he's unknown over here, I reckon, in New Zealand... You know, this pays a little, tips its hat to The Third Man, you know, the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Greatest spy movie ever.
Oh. These are big, wild claims.
I'm just saying, it's not a claim. I'm just going, and also there's a character in here, Pinky, who's a sort of wheeler dealer kind of sharp guy. Which sort of tips its hat to Brighton Rock. I don't know if you've ever read that way back in the day, Graham Greene. So the guy's got, you know, he's clever, Carroll. And
so has he ever been to Cambridge?
I don't know. But the book ends with him looking to become a. He sees this ad in a shop to, you know, £10 and you can go to Australia.
Oh.
And so him and his new girlfriend. They're saying, let's head there. So you can see how he's going to leave now to go to Australia, probably to Melbourne, which a lot of us where his books are set, and we'll have our detective now in a more familiar sort of setting for future books.
Mm.
Found it in the library. liked, I was drawn in by kind of the just the very contemporary look of it.
That car looks like it's alive, doesn't it? It looks malevolent.
Yeah, and it's I think it'll find its readership, even though it's not. It's one of those rare books of its nature not found at Elmo's. But Robert Harris.
Yep.
What's he been doing?
Well, Robert Harris is again one of our people. Act of Oblivion was the last one, which was.
Which I read, enjoyed.
Yeah.
Book clubbed. The book club liked it.
Yeah. Again, these are people who, all these people, are people who can write really well, so book clubs like them.
Yeah.
And the rest of us like them too.
Munich, which I thought was really good. I like his World War II settings in particular.
And Conclave, that was, he's written
V2.
Like,
those things.
And he's written the Roman ones as well.
He doesn't write bad books. I think every one of them there's a high bar and he goes over it all the time.
Yeah, and they're there's always an element of fact, of historical fact in them.
But this is a story of an elderly prime minister and his
much, much younger.
Very, very young.
Special friend.
Special friend. And where's the drama going to come from that?
Well, this is the summer of 1914, which, as you
might recall... Oh, it's the war, of course.
Yes, on the very brink of the war to end all wars, apart from all the ones we've had since. In London, 26-year-old Venetia Stanley, aristocratic, clever, bored, reckless, is having a love affair with the Prime Minister, H.H. Asquith. He writes to her obsessively, sharing the most sensitive matters of state. So this is based in fact.
I think half the correspondence existed, didn't it? And half didn't. Whether it was his or hers.
Yes.
Well, one of the two. And so he then, in a novelistic way, will fill in the other half.
Yeah. Seamlessly weaving fact and fiction in a way that no writer does better, Precipice is the thrilling new novel from Robert Harris. Now, he obviously doesn't have any friends because... Neither Sebastian Faulks nor...
He needs to get on the festival circuit and make some mates.
Or perhaps he just doesn't need the help.
These things are global hits. I mean, if they are...
The Prime Minister had been trying all morning to get hold of Lord Kitchener. Just before he went into yet another cabinet meeting, he told his private office to track him. So it's all, there are powerful figures abroad in the pages of that book.
And here's the thing, though. You can pick up these that pile of books over there written by, leading writers and all that, and you can absolutely trust them to deliver what they always do.
Yeah.
An intelligent, well-shaped, engaging book. And we all go, that's fine, all that. Actually, that's not easy to do.
It's not easy to do after time after time.
I know, and you probably have a bookshop full of not quite, so, who are kind of the next tier down, who are good and will have their own readerships. But these guys are, they're the big ticket writers. They are, and good on them.
Yeah, and the trick to running a bookshop these days is knowing which is which, because... And knowing how many to buy, knowing that something does really, really well and you sell out of it, it's going to be a month before you can get any more.
I know. And you're going to, you point to your customers who come in and they're very excited, planning to read that book, start it that night.
And they will go and have to go somewhere else.
And you break their heart. But no, what you do is you sell them another book.
Yeah, we do, but they don't really enjoy that.
Yeah, they do. No, they trust you. They'll get there. Okay.
What the hell have you got there?
This crossed my desk. The biggest book of all the books today, Map New Zealand. The Alexander Turnbull Library has 66,000 maps.
Okay.
Everybody who ever created a map of New Zealand seems to send one to them.
Okay.
Or they find them. And so what they did, and this is an old book, and... this is how books find you. I saw this in the reserve section in the Greytown Library, and I said, what is that book? And I looked at it, and it inflected.
What's the reserve section? That's the books that have been kept for someone.
Right. So you're online, you have booked the book.
Yeah.
And you've got a little email saying, come and get your book.
Yeah.
And they're all beautifully, alphabetically, with a little paper tag waiting for you. It is absolutely, you know, a gift for books, especially books that are hard to find.
Mm.
And anyway, so this was, and I'd flicked it and I thought, well, that's really interesting. I kind of like maps. Mm. And that there were, so you go through, and I actually, what do you find? Like on page 25, in the most indistinct map that you can actually imagine.
It looks like the original copy of the Treaty of Waitangi.
It's the plan of the Wairarapa in 1861 right. on this bit of paper here. And it goes, while some maps are beautiful artworks and some tell the story of the Neria, this story lies in its provenance, drawn and painted over two sheets. This is an early map of the Wairarapa coast. It was created sometime in 1861 and damaged to provide plentiful information about the early makeup of the regions. Towns of Masterton, Featherston and Carterton are clearly marked, and it is Carterton in which this map's provenance lies. And it tells us the story in 1822, Charles Rooking Carter, trained as a carpenter, and was committed to continuing education. Through his studies, he developed an interest in immigration in New Zealand and arrived with his wife Jane in 1850. We worked as a builder. In 1953, his attachment to the Wairarapa began when he and Joseph Masters talked to Governor George Grey into buying land in the area for settlement. These two men became founding members of the Small Farms Association, responsible for the settlement of Masterton and Greytown. As a result, he acquired a large piece of land known as the Taratahi Block, and in 1959, the town of Three Mile Bush was renamed Carterville. Right, I get the yep, it's all
yep,
right
yep.
to commemorate his work. He shared his knowledge with other settlers, and his generosity provided many of the sites for the town's public buildings. The name's town was eventually changed to Carterton. He loved it, but he spent most of his life actually in England.
Yeah, he did. He wasn't here long.
All the while remaining in contact with the town, an avid book collector, he donated thousands of books to the library, and as a result, it became one of the best regional collections. But among his donations was this map. And that's the provenance that we were building up to. And it talks about the observatory and Carter Courts and the Carter Reserve. But here it was, a map of in 1861. So I thought that was really, really good. Another map that I really liked was the plan of Greytown, which...
Got your house on it.
Pretty good... and it was 1896, and it was, I like the story of that too. The land for the town was surveyed by Corbett, and who laid out the strong, long straight streets and right angles, and it was divided into 120 sections, all right, 60 on each side of the road, and for that you also got a 40-acre block. When you bought the little thing in the town, they gave you another 40 acres. So, I mean, great deal.
especially if you kept it.
And it was kind of, the first settlers kind of arrived in 1854, and within 5 years, Greytown had hotels, shops, and numerous houses within the region's main centres. This was to change when the newly established railway bypassed the town in favour of nearby Carterton and Masterton, which now took over, and Masterton took over as the key town in the district. Anyway.
So you know, I think, don't you, that that's what gives Greytown its character, that nothing happened from about 1850 to...
today?
1998, when someone said, oh, there's a lot of nice old buildings here. And that was because the railway line never went near the place.
Right, it was just bypassed. Leaving this, was the last thing I found was this chart of New Zealand lighthouses, because it's got another chart here of the shipwrecks, and you can barely fit them all in. There were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of ships.
And those are just off the Wairarapa coast.
Yeah, and that was all over. Anyway, they decided to put in lighthouses, and there's a neat map of where they all are, and it was... This was produced in 1900 by the Lands and Survey, and it shows each of the... They had 45 lighthouses with lighthouse people living in the building. Until 1912, all lighthouses were operated by the lighthouse keepers, who usually lived on site, and then they started to automate them. And they used to have fixed lights, but that started to look like the houses that were grow up around the lighthouses, so that wasn't such a good idea. And then they started having them
swizzle around or blink around or something.
And the early lighthouses burned fuel such as paraffin or kerosene, but they all got converted to electricity by the 50s. The majority of them are now solar powered, with the remainder running off mains electricity or diesel. Without keepers to monitoring the lighthouses on a daily basis, the lights are now monitored by a remote control station in Wellington that runs all of them. Each of the lighthouses is visited twice a year when routine maintenance is carried out, and the mundane of household chores is done when the light bulbs are changed. But anyway, great old map. The book was full of old maps, totally intriguing. If you're a map guy or lady, you will absolutely love this book.
Well, we sell quite a lot of books of maps of varying kinds, and the best thing is when, especially the old ones, is when you look at them and say, oh, well, that wasn't right. That bit of, you know, it's the same with, you know, Banks Island and Stewart Peninsula. You don't just by sailing around, you don't get everything right.
But that, well, actually, do you have maps for sale?
We sell some maps, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Because people have their phones these days and their tablets, but some people love a paper map.
Well, I was saying, I quite like a book of road maps if I'm going somewhere where I don't know where I am.
Same.
And the reason for that is because you can see the beginning and the end.
Yeah, perspective, the big picture.
Yeah, whereas if you're...
If you're looking at your phone, you're seeing a little snapshot of part of it.
Yeah, and you can't figure out... It's all very well, you can get to the end of that, but how many more bits like that?
Yeah.
You know, agreed. Before there's the next toilet block or something. So I quite like maps.
Elizabeth Strout and Judy. Okay, here we go, to wind us off.
I'm aware we've got 3 minutes, so I'll just talk briefly about two other new works of fiction we've got from some of our best people. The new Jodi Picoult, called By Any Other Name. Now, most of her stuff is about contemporary issues, and
right. This
is a bit different.
She would pick up, like, suicide or, you know, teenage pregnancy or something like that, you know, and build a book about it.
Yeah. What if the greatest writer of all time isn't who we think he is? In 1581, Amelia Bassano is allowed no voice of her own, but as a Lord Chamberlain's mistress, she has access to the theatre and finds a way to bring her work to the stage secretly. But creating some of the world's greatest dramatic masterpieces comes at a cost. By paying a man for the use of his name, she will write her own out of history. His name? William Shakespeare.
Well, great premise, eh?
Yeah. And then it's another one of these ones where playwright Melina Green has written a new work inspired by the life of her Elizabethan ancestor, Amelia Bassano. So it's one of those...
back and forth.
And same sort of... things. Is Melina, like Amelia, willing to forfeit her credit as an author to see her work performed?
There is no end to books about Shakespeare. Or maybe Miss Bassano, actually, just ripple through our lives.
And that's because then the plays don't all seem the same, do they?
No. It's genius time.
Yeah.
Genius time. I know people who read everything that Jodi Picoult wrote.
Yes.
Yeah, they're absolute fans. Yep. And I have read, if I went back through the, you know, and she's written a lot of books, there would be a couple there I've picked up.
But overwhelmingly female readership, I think.
Agreed.
The other book I'd just like to mention briefly, because people have been asking me when it's coming, Elizabeth Strout, Tell Me Everything. It's in the... the Olive Kitteridge, Lucy, whatever her name is, Lucy Barton sort of series. These are, again, talking about publishing, Nice little hardback.
Heck yeah.
300 odd pages. Priced at the same price as a trade paperback. So, and all her books are in this size. I've never seen a paperback.
Hmm. How much control does the writer have over how it'll be formatted?
Some of them will only let their work be published first in hardback. So all of the Jeffrey Archers, they all come out in hardback.
Richard Ford, I think he does the same.
I'm not sure. And that's because...
they've got clout.
They got clout and they get paid more for that. Yeah. The books are more expensive.
And they're going to last longer.
They are going to last longer, but a lot of fiction, if people get a choice between a hardback and a paperback, they'll take the paperback every time.
Yeah. And also, a lot of fiction today is kind of disposable. You know, it's like you read and leave.
Yeah.
And to get, you know, a good book, if you go, actually, I need to keep that, you know, you may search for a hardback edition just to, you know.
But most people don't.
Yeah, and Elizabeth Strout on the literary end of fiction.
Yeah,
but there is a readership there.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I have friends who are regarded as very, very good readers who read all the sort of the most intelligent books, the ones I sometimes struggle with. they are big fans.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, but, and it's one of those books, I think everybody should give it a go, pick up one, and you never, because that's the whole fun of books, is, getting the match.
Yep.
It's when the book finds you at the right time, when you're ready for it. Well, that brings us to the end of the September edition of Book Lovers Why Rapper, and we look forward to catching up with you in October, when we will learn a little bit about Christina Sanders and her latest book, Kiwi Brown. So it's goodbye from me.
And it's good night from him.